Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Tinseltown Tragedies Uncut. This particular episode contains an uncut interview whose portions were included in the Who Killed Krista Helm episode of the series. On this episode, we speak with writer Stephen Thompson and researcher Renee Thompson. Together, they've assembled a website devoted to Krista Helm's life and unsolved murder at kristahelm.blogspot.com. You can hear the episode Who Killed Krista Helm in its entirety at our website at moviegeeksunited.net.
To get started with, I just want to know from you, Stephen, when Krista, when you started to have a consciousness of Krista and what that, how that led to your chronicling her life and her murder.
Okay, this is really weird. In 2005, I started a blog, and it was just going to be a general pop culture blog, and I was going to, I called it Book Steve's Library because I have a lot of stuff, and I wanted to share my stuff with people on the internet. And one of the things that I did for many, many years was I clipped newspaper ads of movies when they played in the Cincinnati area. And I would clip ads of movies I wanted to see or movies I did see and paste them in scrapbooks. I ended up with 28 scrapbooks eventually, but they were huge and hard to carry and hard to store. So I went back in the 90s and went through them and took out the ads that I thought were still pretty cool and ditched the scrapbooks and just tossed the ads into a box. When I started the blog, one of the things that I did is I wanted to share some of the cool movie ads of movies that you never heard of anymore. So I decided to start a feature called Movies That Fell Through the Cracks. And I just randomly opened the box and reached into it, and the first thing I picked out was Let's Go for Broke. And I said, yeah, I don't know anything about this movie. I never did see it, but I remember them advertising it on the radio. And let's look it up now that we've got the internet, find out what we can find out about it, and I'll write about it on my blog. So I went to look it up, and it was not listed on IMDb, nor was its star, Krista Helm, nor was any of the other cast members that are listed in the ad listed on IMDb. And I'm like, wait a minute, this movie really did fall through the cracks. What's going on here? I did eventually find that Krista was listed on IMDb as Krist Helm. Not Krista, but Krist Helm. And the reason for that was because she had made another movie, a low-budget horror movie, where they had accidentally listed her that way in the opening credits.
Wow, wow.
And the reason that I found out that Let's Go for Broke was not listed was that even though I remember saturation radio advertising here in this area, it never opened anywhere else. It had its world premiere here in Cincinnati. The ad that I had, the ad that I had clipped out, did not have the top inch or so which said, world premiere, come meet the stars this Saturday night. I clipped that part off, so I didn't remember that since I didn't actually go. And I only found that out when I went to the local public library and checked the newspapers there on the microfilm and found the same copy of the ad that I had cut out.
Let me ask
I found out about it and became intrigued.
Let me ask you this. Why Cincinnati? Does the movie have ties to Cincinnati? Was it shot there at all?
My original thought was that it probably had some sort of tie to Cincinnati. But then, here's the thing. In 1972, do you know the movie Billy Jack?
Sure.
Billy Jack was released by Warner Brothers and was a huge flop. Absolute major flop. They pulled it from the theaters before its initial run was even done. But Tom Laughlin, who made Billy Jack, thought, no, this is a good movie. So he bought the film, and he did what they call four-walling, which is basically he bought out theaters in Cincinnati, just randomly having chosen Cincinnati, in order to re-release Billy Jack with saturation advertising. And it became a huge national hit to the point where Warner Brothers picked up distribution again, and they ended up doing, what, 3 sequels. Mm. So after that, there were several other films that tried to open in Cincinnati and do the same thing. There's a movie called Homebodies, which was a little horror film that was partly shot here, but they did the same thing with attempting to overly promote it here, only it didn't catch on. So I'm thinking maybe that was the reason that they did it in Cincinnati. But later I found out that one of the co-stars of the film, the guy who plays the villain, Frank Rader, had actually been part of the repertory company of the University of Cincinnati a year or two before that. So even though he wasn't from here, it's possible he suggested that maybe based on the success of the Billy Jack thing.
Okay. Well, I want to talk to you about the film and your efforts to kind of uncover it and your tracking down people that were responsible for making it, because it's really impressive what you accomplished there. outside of the film, just in terms of Krista's story, what most fascinated you about that?
The fact that I couldn't find anything about it. Literally, what little tiny bits were out there were intriguing. It was a week or so after I originally posted the blog post that I think I found out that she had been murdered, because I didn't even know that. She had been murdered in 1977. The film had played in Cincinnati at Christmas of 74. So I'm like, what did she do in the meantime? Why was the film never released? What happened to this girl? What is her story, and why is there nothing about it on the internet where you can find the most obscure little things? So I started looking and looking, and I found out that her daughter had worked with a show called Celebrity Justice, who had done a television thing about Krista's murder a year or so before. And then I said, maybe I can find her daughter and find out some information. One thing led to another. I found John O'Dowd, who was working with the daughter on, the story and investigating into that. John had written a lot for Film Facts magazine and various other magazines, Psychotronic and things like that, about obscure actresses. And he had become intrigued with her situation as well. So basically, I joined up with them in terms of doing research, and it kind of jump-started John's research, and we got quite a bit done fairly quickly. As I put it, I started feeling like Dana Andrews in the movie Laura, where all you've got is the portrait of this woman who was murdered, and he's trying to piece together her life and getting all these conflicting details and reports from various different people, and he's becoming more and more intrigued by her, even though he can never possibly meet her.
It is kind of a labyrinth of a story, because there are so many players in Krista's life. But why do you think, just from a media perspective, I mean, it has all the elements of a great story. I mean, if you're a media person, the ingenue in Hollywood and gets in with the wrong crowd or some people that might be a bit dangerous in the nature of the murder. And why do you think it was ignored?
It wasn't ignored at the time that it happened, but it was kind of quickly pushed under the rug. There's a, I don't know how old you are, but they used to be in the Sunday newspapers, the little rotogravure magazines, and there were always these little questions people would write in about celebrities. And there's one that you can find all over the internet from one of these magazines from back in 77 where somebody said, how come I never read anything about what happened with the investigation of the murder of Krista Helm? And essentially the answer was that the police just decided not to talk about it publicly. Hmm. So there's a whole bunch of theories that somebody more powerful than we know pulled some strings and just said, don't push this. Could be. We know some names now that she was connected with that might have done that. Or that they just really never could find anything and pretty well gave up on it.
Yeah. And Renee,
I think it was a combination of both myself.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, Renee, what you, when your involvement in this kind of started, and how you were drawn to Krista's story.
Well, Stephen's always been the writer in the family. I've always been the researcher. Many, many years ago, when dinosaurs walked the earth, I actually worked as a private investigator for an insurance adjuster. And I've done research on and off through the years, whether it as a hobby or in the course of whatever work I was in. And so when Stephen started needing to find information, who's he going to turn to? You know, so you know, he's like, well, come on, Digger, I need you. And so as we started not only looking at her death, but looking at her life, because I've done genealogy for about 30 years, I came in from the, you know, with the early stuff, you know, where she was born, where things happened, so that we started getting an idea of who Krista was above and beyond being the victim of a murder.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
I think that's really valuable, because I mean, what drew me to it, and what kept me there, was the human part of it. I mean, the sensationalized kind of Hollywood actress wants to make it big, and she falls in with the wrong people. I mean, that's enough to lure you in. But what really kept me there was you know, her personal story. So I really appreciated that you guys invested so much in that, which is a good place to go now, because I mean, I'd like you guys to set up for me who she was, where she came from. I mean, first of all, Krista Helm was an assumed stage name that she took later in her
right.
life. But what were her beginnings like?
Dear?
Well, her given name, her birth name, was Sandra Lynn Woolfield.
Woolfield.
Woolfield. I always pronounce that incorrectly.
Yeah, no D.
And even from the start, from when we interviewed family members, other people, her old roommate, this was a woman who was, she knew what she wanted, she was going to go for it. She
basically wanted to be originally she wanted to be a model. And she and a friend of hers decided they were going to go to Chicago. They were in Milwaukee. They were going to go to Chicago and get a job at the Playboy Club, figuring they can work into modeling from there. And if I recall correctly, that never happened, but they did end up in New York City, where they did get some modeling jobs. Supposedly, Krista did, like, hand modeling for print ads and things like that. So you're never going to find that, because how are you going to recognize her hands anywhere? There were some rumors that she may have done some other type of modeling, but that kind of rumor has dogged all through this case, and there's been no proof that she ever did anything X-rated in terms of modeling or movies or anything like that. In fact, at one point, the cold case officer in charge of the case told me that, in fact, they had discovered two pornographic films that she had starred in the early 1970s, but they were unable to find copies. And I'm like, oh, come on, this is the internet age. It took me 5 minutes to find copies of them, and she's not in them.
Mm.
So it was a blonde girl that was in them, but it wasn't her. So, again, there's no evidence that she did any of that type of thing. But while she was in New York, she decided she liked being, for all intents and purposes, a kept woman. She liked the concept of people spending money on her, and she ran with that. So she would find guys who would go out with her and essentially put her up in apartments and buy her nice things and fancy things and all that. According to the information we've got, she was with this gentleman who was a Broadway producer, and he loaned her money to invest in his play, and she invested the money, and the play was a huge success, and she made a considerable profit on the deal. And she told him she wanted to be a movie star, and he said, okay. So that's when he decided he was going to go into making movies, and he decided to make Let's Go for Broke.
Okay, I gotta interject here because we're missing something important beforehand.
Okay.
Back it up. When Krista was 16 or 17, she met the man who would be her husband, Paul Gary Clemons. He was a business owner. He ran a karate schools. And her friend Diane Mitchell even said, from the earliest point, she says, I'm going to marry that man. Well, she got pregnant with Nicole, her daughter, and they ended up getting married. But just as quickly, the story goes that the honeymoon, wasn't even a honeymoon. I'm not sure he didn't leave during the reception. He left that quickly.
Mm.
And she was with Nicole. So when you hear about her going for these modeling jobs and things like this, there was another reason she was driven. She was driven because of Nicole and the fact that Nicole did have some medical conditions that needed to be taken care of. When Stephen, are we mentioning who the producer was? Or
I wouldn't know.
Okay. When she became involved with the producer and he bought her a home in the Hamptons, the first thing she did was she brought Nicole there so that Nicole could get her eye surgery done. She cared very much for that child, you can tell.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, she knew that the way that she was obtaining money was not a situation in which you wanted to raise a child.
One of the pictures that we were provided by Nicole was a glamour-type shot that Krista had taken of herself, and it was cropped for the actual glamour shot, but if you have the uncropped version, which she sent us, you can see Nicole kind of playing down in the bottom or sleeping or something. So it was kind of cute. But another thing that, going back to Milwaukee, was every step of the way through her story from the beginning to the end, there is a vague mob ties thing going. The restaurant where she had her first job was reportedly run by the mob. The guy she married with the karate schools was reportedly connected to the mob. When she was in New York, she supposedly worked at a place that was connected to the mob. Her first movie, the horror movie where they billed her as Christ Helm, was directed by Gerard Damiano, who directed Deep Throat, which was mob-funded. And then towards the end, she supposedly sent a message to her roommate that she had that she had fallen in with somebody who was mob connected that, you know, was potentially a problem. So, and then you've got the whole situation that came out with the 48 Hours where the guy from the Sopranos cleaned out all of her stuff from her apartment.
Let me ask you this about something about her personality, because there definitely seemed to be a rebellious streak in her. Where do you think that came from?
I'm not entirely sure. We've still got large blank areas in our investigation of her early life, and unfortunately, due to lack of money, time, and everything else, we've not been in a position to do any in-depth investigating other than what we've already got. So I'm not entirely sure where the rebellious streak came from, but it's definitely there. She almost had – it's almost like you're talking about four or five different people when you talk to people about her. On the one hand, she was described as a very, very strong woman, a very, very beautiful woman, On the other hand, someone would turn right around and say she was abusive, manipulative, always a liar. Someone else said she was the most trustworthy person I ever met. Someone else said she was incredibly loyal. Someone else said she would turn right around and you know, turn against you. So literally, when you're getting all this information, sometimes on the same day when we were really into this and I was talking to different people, it sounds like you're hearing different people described.
I think there was no question she was driven.
Oh, yeah. She wanted to be a star. She didn't want to take all of the time and steps that it took to become a star, but she wanted more than anything to be a star.
Did she have talent?
Put it this way, in Let's Go for Broke, I've seen a lot worse performances from actresses in the 70s who became fairly big stars. Mm-hmm. Was she good? Okay, probably. Was she great? Certainly not. She had talent. She had potential. I think her best bit is the four-minute sequence she did on Starsky and Hutch, where she does a little comedy bit with Starsky. She has really good comic timing in that. But I think that's better than anything she did that people are familiar with.
I think if she had taken the time to study, she had potential. Would she have been great? No. Could she have been a good working actress? Yeah.
Yeah.
The woman who played the villain in Let's Go for Broke told me that she had been asked to kind of help her along and give her tips and acting lessons, if you will. And Krista said, what do I need that for? I just, you know, need a sugar daddy. You need a sugar daddy too. Things like that.
Wow. Well,
and then towards the end, she really wasn't even trying to do acting anymore. Towards the end, she had decided she wanted to be a singer. And again, that wasn't unheard of in those days. An awful lot of people became successful disco singers, which was apparently the type of music she was trying to do, without having any real talent, just because of all the production involved. And she had Frankie Crocker involved, who was a big-time New York producer who went on to be one of the original VJs on VH1. And he was producing her album, supposedly, because she had something on him. And I don't know what happened to any of that music or anything. It's all disappeared. So I've not heard any of it. But she does sing the theme song to Let's Go for Broke in the movie, and she's not bad.
Well, I'm curious to know your take on how assertive she was. I mean, obviously, she suffered a very grisly end. But was she, before that, is there a sense that you guys have that she was unfairly manipulated, or do you always see her as somebody in the driver's seat that was making her own destiny, that she knew exactly what she was doing and all these dealings with various people?
According to a lot of reports, towards the end, she was having some issues, possibly even some health issues that we've not had substantiated anywhere, so I don't want to get into that. But suddenly things seemed to be going down for her. She was living in an apartment. She had a roommate. She was working in a restaurant. Not at all unlike other starlets in Hollywood, but at the same time, a big come down for somebody who had been, you know, living the high life for so long, literally it being the 70s. So I think for the most part, she was very assertive. Everything that I gather, she was in some cases assertive to the point of coming across as mean, in spite of the fact that so many people talk about how nice she was. But at the same time, I think a lot of that was probably trying to hide the basic vulnerability that sort of led to her falling to the point where she did, as her career didn't take off the way she had wanted it to.
I don't...
Yeah.
If she had been a man, they would have just said she's assertive.
Oh, yeah.
But she was flying by the seat of her pants, and I think she knew that because she wasn't coming from a situation where she had it's not like she had studied acting. She was she knew how to get things one way, and it's that old thing, if all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the way she dealt with everything was, what man can I go after?
Put it this way, before she even did Let's Go for Broke, let alone anything else, she turned up an awful lot in Earl Wilson's gossip columns, which were syndicated throughout the country. Why? She was a nobody. Why was she turning up in Earl Wilson's gossip columns probably a dozen times? All I can figure is because she's sending him press releases. She's calling him up and saying, hey, I went out with Joe Namath the other day. You want to hear about it?
Mm.
So she's out there promoting herself here as a star. She wanted to be a star, not an actress.
She wanted to be a celebrity.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, to that end, how many – I know she did – she has several TV credits, as we mentioned, Starsky and Hutch and Wonder Woman. And
right.
But what? How many movies did she do?
Well, she did Legacy of Satan, where, ironically, she gets stabbed to death by a knife at the end of the film. And then she did Let's Go for Broke, which was unreleased. There is a film called Lady J, which is supposedly a re-edited version of Let's Go for Broke that was advertised in Variety as coming out the year after Krista died, but it never came out. According to the information that we have, though, it was not just Let's Go for Broke. It was additional, supposedly more explicit scenes were shot in Hollywood, Florida, a year after the film had finished shooting otherwise, and those were edited into the film, and it was retitled Lady J in an effort to try to sell it. So that would technically count as like a different movie, I guess.
Illusions of a Lady, that was in 74.
No. Illusions of a Lady, she claimed that she wrote the X-rated movie Illusions of a Lady. She was living with its director, Joseph Middleton, at the time, and she actually, again, sent this out as a press release. So there's an interview with her in the newspaper about breaking up with this X-rated film director. And she claims she wrote it and was the co-producer of it and that he took his name or took her name off of it after they broke up. In a recent interview that I read with him, he says that, no, that wasn't the case, that he told who did write it and everything else. And he apparently speaks very, very highly of her. I had his cell phone number a couple years ago but lost it, so I've not been able to speak with him. But Nicole did and said he speaks very, very highly of her mother at this stage, in spite of the fact that they broke up that way. So she may or may not have been associated with writing that movie, but she certainly wasn't in it. And, again, the rumors of her being in adult films, someone on IMDb describes a pornographic film from 1972 that they swear she is in. They say her name's in the credits, and it's obviously her. They go into great depth and detail about it. However, that film is not known even to the most, pardon the expression, hardcore aficionados of that type of movie. So if nobody's ever heard of it, I'm saying the guy made it up.
Yeah, yeah. So let's get into the odyssey of Let's Go for Broke, and then we'll touch upon the events that led to her murder. Now, how did it turn up for you finally? What, tell me about the journey, how long it took, and what led you to actually being able to get your hands on a copy, because you have obviously seen it in its entirety.
Yes.
Now. Okay.
Yes. I have one of, I'm told, just a handful of copies. I'm not entirely sure how many. And I was asked to sign a paper saying that I would not make any additional copies, put it on the Internet, or otherwise disseminate it. So in order to get a copy of it at that point, I was obsessed, so I definitely signed that. Basically, what it was the clues I had were all in that original ad. It had the names of a half a dozen people who were in the film. I was able to track down the woman who played the villain, who simply went by the name Chitra. She had one other credit, which was the movie To Sir with Love with Sidney Poitier, where she plays one of the students. And it gives her last name, Chitra Nyagi. And I was able to track down Chitra Nyagi, who in fact was, are you in Brooklyn?
No, it's odd. My show number is in Brooklyn. I'm actually in Florida.
Ah. Okay. I was going to say,
yeah.
Because Chitra is a professor at a university in Brooklyn.
Oh,
and
wow.
I tracked her down, and I called her and asked her if she was the same Chitra who was in Let's Go for Broke, and she was absolutely stunned. She said, how did you ever even hear of that movie? It was never finished. She didn't even know that it had premiered here, let alone that it was ever even edited. So I spoke with her at some length and got a lot of information from her. From there, I was able to track down the credited director. I say the credited director because we found out later that half the film was directed by another person who I was able to identify later on, but I haven't been able to track him down. But I tracked down the credited director who was now teaching in Los Angeles and contacted him. And I'm talking to him late one night, and I said something about, it's a shame, you know, nobody will ever see that movie, because since it was never released, there were never a lot of copies made. So therefore, that's why, you know, there was no copies to be found, because they simply never made a lot. And I'm talking to him, and I said, it's a shame nobody will ever see that movie. And he says, oh, I've got a copy. And I'm like, what? Because Nicole had told me she had a VHS tape with some clips from it, but that was all she had. And when this guy told me he had a copy of it, I'm like, I have to see that copy. And he said, but it's 35 millimeter. And he said, so I can't afford to turn a 35 millimeter into a digital copy or anything like that. And then when CBS got involved and wanted to do the 48 hours, which they had contacted John about that after we did a rather significant piece on the internet about her, about Krista's life and death. And CBS, I said to CBS, hey, I know where I can get you a copy of the movie if you want to use some clips in your show, but you have to promise to, let me have a copy of it. And I said, the guy can't afford to transfer it from 35 millimeter to DVD. And they said, oh, we've got facilities for that. You know, we're a TV network. We can do that. So they called him. I don't know if money was exchanged or anything, but they, you know, got his permission to borrow his 35 millimeter copy. They made a copy for their records. They made a copy for me. They made a copy for Nicole. I have reason to believe there is another copy out there. But to the best of my knowledge, that's it.
So
the producer told me he didn't even want a copy.
He didn't want one?
No, he said it was a nightmare to him. It was something that is long past, and he has long put in his past, and he didn't want to deal with anymore. So I spoke with him about it. He said I could have the copy under those circumstances, but he did not want a copy himself.
So tell me what it was like, you know, this being such a long investigation for you into the whereabouts of this movie, when you're finally able to sit in front of the TV and watch it for yourself, what was that experience like?
It was impressive as all get out. No matter how bad that movie was, I was going to love it. You know that. but even I think the best part was I was finally able to convince the Internet Movie Database to add it in. Because prior to that, I had sent it, and they said, you know, we don't know you. Why should we believe you? So, no, we're not going to add it in, and we're not going to change her name from Christ to Krista. But eventually, because I had it and was able to give them all the details of it, they went ahead and added it, and now it's got all the information in there.
So what is it?
It was great fun.
What is it about? She's got the leading role, doesn't she?
Oh, yeah. The original ad on the radio that I remember, the tagline was, "The mob says, let's go for broke. Krista Helm is Jackie Broke in Let's Go for Broke." And essentially, she's a crusading reporter, and she gets involved in this situation where these girls are being kidnapped and taken to this island for something, and she gets herself kidnapped and goes there and ends up saving them. The thing about it is, it was originally supposed to be a straightforward adventure story, And then the second director who was brought in added comedy to it. So they ditched a lot of the scenes from the first director, and they added scenes that are ridiculous, like this guy has a ray that turns people into dog food, literally dog food, things like that. Again, there were plenty worse films that played drive-ins in the 1970s. I can name you 50 of them right now. And so just the silly plot is certainly not a reason that this could not have been released and been a success.
Can you tell if she had high hopes for it, if she was crestfallen whenever it it failed
it's
to get a release?
It's my understanding that, yes, she kept coming back to it. That's why she agreed to shoot the extra scenes for it. They continued from 74 when they played here in Cincinnati, of which it definitely had fans, because long before I got the film, some guy wrote me and told me what it was about and said that he went to see it twice. And but they continued to try and find distributors for it right up to the point after her death, even, where you'd think somebody at the very least would have picked it up to exploit the name value of her death. But even then, they couldn't sell it. So I don't understand what that was all about.
So watching the 48 Hours mystery, which was my introduction to this whole story, you know, they mention a lot of big Hollywood heavyweights that she had involvements with. People like Warren Beatty was a name that came up a lot. And
Warren Beatty was involved with everybody in the 70s.
It's very difficult to limit that list. But
put it this way, Warren Beatty was in the news today being involved with a young starlet. So pick a different one.
But
seriously,
Polanski, the Shah of Iran, was that all conjecture, or is that kind of provable?
Is proven. There are photos of her with George Hamilton,
Joe Namath,
Michael Sarrazin. Nicole remembers her being with Mick Jagger, Engelbert Humperdinck, and the Shah of Iran. In fact, Nicole said she accidentally picked up a funny-looking cigarette that Mick Jagger had left in the ashtray that smelled really weird, and Mick kind of went ballistic on her when she was like 8. So,
wow.
Put that down.
Yeah, and she remembers swimming in Engelbert Humperdinck's pool while Mom and Engelbert were smooching over on the side and things like that. So a lot of that is true, and these are, you know, the big-name people. She liked to be seen with celebrities, so we don't necessarily know how much of a relationship she had with all of these people, but she definitely did have a, some sort of a friendship with them, at least. And we know she is credited in the Earl Wilson column as having been a steady date to Joe Namath for quite a while, because he wrote about their relationship once. And the Michael Sarrazin got a couple of write-ups from Earl Wilson also.
As best as you could tell, was anyone particularly special to her in her life, or did she consider them all stepping stones in a way?
Honestly, I think she considered most of them, at least, to be stepping stones. It seems like she was with Michael Sarrazin longer than she was with the others, and he reportedly was really, really knocked for a loop when she was killed, even though they had long since broken up. And I'm sure it's total coincidence, but he went to Italy right after that and made a couple of movies, and then his career just never picked up again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he had been a fairly big star, and he suddenly was getting a sixth or seventh billing in German dramas, you know, and things like that.
Yeah,
I think he hosted Saturday Night Live once after that, but that was it. And that was pretty much timed to when, you know, they had been together. I don't think in any possible way that ties him, you know, to her death, because by all accounts, you know, they broke up and they were still friends and all that.
Yeah. So tell me, you mentioned the music, because there are some major female players in this mystery as well, and several of them came to play when she was recording her album, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure who you were talking about in terms of major. There are a number of women connected with the album, and supposedly the DNA that they found evidence was female DNA. It's safe to assume that those would be the suspects, but supposedly they have all been checked out and determined that it was not their DNA.
Yeah, up until that time, we were all looking, going, okay.
Yeah, we had a couple of suspects that we were fairly convinced must have been the one, but...
But the DNA proved us wrong.
Where did they find the DNA on her?
It was one of those situations whereby they had kept it over the years. It was just with things, you know, tied to the case, and now they have tests that they didn't have back then. So
right.
They couldn't do it back then. I think it was things that they had gotten, like, from under her fingernails at the time, and they had just in evidence bags, I guess. And so they were able to conduct the tests. And even on the TV show, they show a number of the people being tested, and we had talked to the cold case people since then, and others were tested, and nobody really matched it. The general consensus is that the way she was killed seems to be the type of thing that is done in passion, the type of thing that is done by a woman because a woman wanted to destroy her beauty.
Yeah, all of her wounds were upper chest on up. This was the neck, the face. They were going after her. This wasn't like a mugging where you're going to go after, you know, you're going to try to cut the body. This was
right.
Going after the face. So this was personal.
Yeah. That
and it would have been so overboard if it were just a simple mugging. Were they thinking that she was stabbed from behind, meaning someone reached around from behind her and stabbed her in the chest?
Not that I've ever heard, no.
No.
It's supposedly she saw someone or ran into someone that knew her. And she knew, and it occurred then. There are some reports, and I don't know if this has been verified because I've seen it yes and I've seen it no, that she was also hit on the head with a blunt object, possibly by a second person. There is a book, or should I say a pamphlet, on Amazon about Krista, which actually has the crime scene photos on its cover, which is pretty tacky, but it's written by a fairly well-known true crime writer, and it's only 8 pages long, and it's horribly written because it spends an awful lot of time saying the wind was flowing through her hair as she drove the car. How do you know? You weren't there. You know, I mean, if you're going to write factual stories, you have to stick to the facts.
Yeah.
You can't just conjecture. But in his version, and again, this is only 8 pages long, but it does have some stuff in there that we know from talking to the cold case people that is not public knowledge. So I will grant that what else is in there may be also fairly accurate. In his version, she was followed, and she knew she was being followed, and it was when she got out of her car that she was confronted. Again, I've never seen that anywhere else. But that is in that little pamphlety book there.
And this occurred in front of an agent's house.
Well, it depends on your definition. It was the guy she was going to get drugs from.
Okay.
He was, I think, an agent, but...
Okay. And who discovered... Were there any witnesses? I think there was an ear witness...
There were a couple of people who heard things and ran into the body not long afterwards. I had always heard it that they had tried to push the body underneath a car, not her car, which it wasn't her car anyway, it was her roommate's car, but not under the car she had been driving even, but underneath the car, and seeing the crime scene photos, which I don't know where this guy got them because the cold case department obviously would not share them with us, and I understood that, and yet he had them. That seems to be exactly the case. They had tried to push the body underneath a car so it wouldn't be found right away. But a couple of just people who lived in the neighborhood, as I understand it, are the ones who found the body. And it was still overnight, in the middle of the night, when the police were there.
Mm.
And it was the next morning that her roommate identified the body.
I saw the watching the 48 hours, and I don't know if I just saw a partial copy of it, but
there's several edits of it too.
Okay, well, I saw an edit that was incredibly frustrating because when it ended, they had approached a woman that she was photographed
yeah.
with that they thought she had a relationship with, and the woman said, "I've never been to that part of California. I don't know who that person is."
Right.
Do we know anything about that?
That was the second version of it. After it aired the first time, they were able to track her down. She was considered, for a while, the main suspect. And she denied being the right person, even. We talked to the cold case people after that aired, and they said that they've got enough evidence from her own family to indicate that she was, in fact, the same person. And yet she took the DNA test reluctantly, but she did take it, and she was cleared.
Okay.
Yeah, during her music career, Krista ticked an awful lot of people off.
Yeah, she seemed to be, and again, it was the 70s, so we try not to judge here. She seemed to be having an affair with this person to spite this person, while this person was having an affair with her to spite another person, all at the same time. So there were plenty of people who were mad at her during this period.
There was a situation, now Stephen, catch me on this, it was either the night before or two nights before her death. One of her backup singers caught her in bed with her boyfriend.
The backup singer's boyfriend.
The backup
singer's
boyfriend.
Supposedly the night before, yes.
And so, you know, we were able to track that woman down, and they tested her, and she was innocent of anything. But I mean, it was like. Krista, was there anyone in town you haven't ticked off, dear?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think she thrived on drama and conflict?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And like I said,
well, that
Frankie
was a simple
Crocker
answer to a simple question. Yeah. Yeah.
Frankie Crocker was producing her album, and again, he was a big name DJ in New York. He's the one who famously tried to ride, or did ride, a white stallion into Studio 54, the big disco. But she supposedly was telling people that, you know, she had blackmail material on him, and that's why he was producing her album when she was a nobody.
Well, speaking of blackmail, I mean, that's a big part of the story, is the supposed audio tapes that
mm-hmm.
that it's been said she kept in her possession of her various intimate encounters with various people in power. Is that truthful? Because I heard that she didn't keep a diary, but she did keep audio tapes.
Oh no, she kept
diary. We've heard both that there was a diary and the audio tapes. There are excerpts from the one or two tapes that are still around that were on the 48 hours. So it's obviously true that they did have that she did have tapes. How much she had and how many she had, I'm not sure, because as I'm sure you realize, it wasn't as easy to surreptitiously record people in those days as
mm-hmm.
it is today. Today you stick a little thing in your pocket, nobody has a clue. In those days you got to carry around a big old tape recorder.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much of that there was, or whether it was meant as blackmail material, although I don't know why else she would be saving it. But the thing is, why would she need blackmail material? She's never had a problem getting what she wanted from men. I mean, that was her whole thing all through her life. If she wanted something, she would find a man, and would she trade sex for it? Sometimes. But at the same time, that was kind of the way people did things in the 70s in that crowd. So,
I guess the theory was that perhaps she was if she failed to make it big in entertainment, that she was going to write a book about
that
her
exploits. That is one of the rumors, yeah. But I can't imagine anybody touching it in those days. Nowadays, there's plenty of publishers that would put that out. But in those days, people were a little more circumspect. If there was anything questionable, they would not come out.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know about that.
You don't think so?
No. I think that she might have had to have waited another couple of years, but I think in her mind, she'd have had the goods to be able to put Nicole through college.
If she waited until like the 2000s, yeah, she could have made a fortune.
All she would have had to have done is wait until the 80s, and I mean, look at the
Well, yeah, that's
people.
When the revelations started coming out about Kennedy and I guess things
yeah.
like that, which they all covered up back in the day.
That's just it. You have to understand, the one thing that I don't judge, but I look at the fact this woman was going to do whatever she needed to do to support her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she had Nicole living across the country. She did not want Nicole would come out on regular visits to see her mom. But her stability was someplace else so that Nicole could do what Nicole was going to do to support, or what Krista was going to do to support Nicole.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, like I said, not the way I would have gone about it, but in her mind, this is what she had to work with. I think she had better skills. I think she had more skills than she realized.
Oh, she did everything right. She sent out all those press releases when she was a nobody and actually got her name in the gossip columns. To put it bluntly, she slept with all the right people. I mean, she should have been a huge star. She was not untalented. And so I'm still not entirely sure, even after all that we've looked into, why she didn't make it.
Well, let me ask you this. Have you had any conversations with her roommate?
I have not. I know John is actually fairly close with her. I actually have exchanged a couple of emails with her. That was the extent of it.
Well, she wrote John something that she said you can share this with Jamie and he can include it in the podcast. But, I mean, since you guys have worked so much on her story, I want to run some of this by you and get your take on it.
Okay.
Because obviously I don't know the roommate. I don't necessarily know where she's coming from. But she writes, there was no diary. There were tapes in my possession. She played a few of them to me. Lenny Brain called me after her death. Barron, okay.
Yeah.
Called me after her death, only wishing to snag Krista's wardrobe and a few cheap furs. I gave him the tapes as requested, not wishing to embarrass several decent public figures who were mentioned on them. Which, that story would be much different than what was told on the 48 Hours episode that attributed that to Tony Cicero, right? That he went into the apartment and took something from her bedroom.
Exactly, although the story is, I heard it, and again, this is just conjecture as well, because we had heard none of that until the 48 Hours. They sprung that one on us. Even though we were working closely with them, they sprung that one on us. The story, as I had heard it, was Lenny is the one who put the guy up to going there and doing that. He didn't go himself to do it. So when she says she gave them to Lenny, it might be that she gave them to him.
And, Stephen, who was it that we just found out the guy was actually dating Krista's sister?
Oh, yeah, the guy from The Sopranos, I keep forgetting his name, was dating Krista's sister at the time that all this happened. So he would have been involved in their little unit there anyway. But Lenny Barron, he was a friend and business partner of Krista's in New York. They had a fashion design thing going for a while. He was fairly big in the gay community in New York, and it was through him that she actually got her picture in a lot of the gay magazines like After Dark and things like that, just posing with various people.
He would design her outfits, make her outfits, then make sure that she got her picture taken.
Yeah. And then when she went to Hollywood, she made sure that Lenny got to go along with her, and he became a fairly good, fairly successful clothing designer for movies. In fact, he did the movie Hell Night with Linda Blair and became such close friends with Linda Blair that the two of them went on to do an internet show together for years about gardening, of all things. There's a couple examples of it on YouTube.
Yeah.
But well, then Lenny died just before we started all this investigation, so he probably could have cleared up almost everything, actually. But no, he died about a year before we started all this.
Well, if you had to speculate, does the mob have any involvement in this in your mind?
I don't think so. As I say, it's hard to say completely not, because there are ties all through her life to the mob. Indirect, but always there. And yet, I don't see anything connected with her murder. Certainly that's not the way the mob kills anybody. I mean, never minding the movies, just look at real life. Everything you've ever heard and seen about the mob, they don't stab people 33 times. If they're going to kill you, they just kill you. No, I don't really think they had anything to do with it. It's entirely possible that she was in trouble with somebody connected with the mob, as she supposedly hinted to, I think it was Darlene. But I don't think that had anything to do with her death either. I think she just literally led too reckless a life for her own good, and as you said before, thrived on the drama of it all.
You know, the cold case, there's obviously a department in the LA, in the police department,
right,
that deals with cold cases. I mean, I've been reading a lot about it, because all of these things that we're covering on the series, most of them are cold cases, and you know, even the Black Dahlia has two detectives assigned to it.
Still? Wow, I didn't know that.
Still, I mean, they're not investigating it, but they're assigned to it. but Krista, I mean, that's obviously a more recent case, and she has been called in some circles the Black Dahlia of the 70s.
Now, what did I call her here? I called her the disco Black Dahlia.
Yeah.
Yeah. So where does that stand, that case, do you know?
The last time we talked to them directly, which was been within the last year, the officer in charge of the cold case, as you say, there's like two of them assigned, and they really don't spend a lot of time on a daily or weekly basis working on them. It's just as something comes up, they look into it. And so every time we would get some new little bit of information, and there's been actually quite a bit this past year that we've passed on to them and to Nicole that we probably shouldn't get into here, simply because, you know, who
it's
knows.
It's still an active
going.
Investigation.
Yeah. But that said, the last time we talked to them, they were pretty well back to square one.
They, I mean, they've got the DNA, so when they find the right person, when they get the right hit, and I honestly believe that what will happen is somebody's relative is going to go to jail. And when that DNA gets into the system, it'll do a ping. Because I doubt that you're probably talking to someone, you're talking about someone who is going to be in their, 70s, late
yeah.
60s, 70s, maybe their 80s. They're not likely to be having their DNA taken by the police at this point. If it comes out, what's going to happen is there's some relative, you know, somebody's grandson, somebody's nephew, somebody donates, for an organ thing, and they do a DNA test, and they're going to get a ping off of that. But it's this is one that the longer it goes, find a name. Yeah.
But there's been
that's what's
two
so
or three
discouraging
instances.
About it.
Well, that's just it, though. There's been two or three instances within the past 6 months or so of cold cases from 30, 40 years ago being solved. So that's encouraging to me that there is still a chance, especially as long as we just don't let it die off. And more people like yourself are discovering it and keeping it out there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in your heart of hearts, you're very hopeful that one day this will be solved?
Oh, yeah.
Eventually, yeah.
I mean, we got into it just almost accidentally. Literally, I just wondered, why isn't that movie listed on IMDb? And next thing you know, we're investigating a murder. It's like, yeah, my wife said she was a private investigator, but she talked to drunks and said,
yeah,
you know, why did you hit the tree? It's not the same, you know? And here we are investigating this murder, and, you know, you want to have some success. We had some victories in terms of getting some information, finding some people that the police couldn't find.
blowing away the 48 hours.
Oh, yeah. The guy at CBS that produced the show, I'm on the phone with him and I'm giving him some information. He says, you know, I'm sitting here with one of the most powerful communications setups, one of the most powerful computer research things, and I couldn't find that information, and you just gave me three different things I couldn't find. So, you know,
he came to the house. He's sitting.
Oh yeah,
on
they
our,
flew out here.
They
and
flew
it,
out
it,
here.
Interviewed us. It was great.
And we ordered a pizza, and he's sitting here, and I basically was working off of index cards, and he would say something, and I'd flip an index card, and okay, that's the information you're looking for there, and he'd ask something else. That's the information.
Yeah.
And he's looking at me, going, "How did you this stuff?" And it's like, I'm a genealogist.
Yeah,
well,
they flew out to interview us. They flew out to interview John in New Jersey, and I think they flew to Vermont to interview Nicole. None of us ended up on camera. I don't think Nicole was on camera. She might have been. But John and I didn't end up on camera, but we got a nice thank you credit at the end of the show.
Mm. So I want to know from a personal standpoint, because I've heard some stories and read some people that write biographies, for instance. I mean, they get. I just spoke to someone that wrote a biography on Peg Entwistle, our first episode, the woman that jumped off the Hollywood sign, and he became so kind of invested in. I don't want to use the word obsessed, but invested in her story, that he began to feel a big responsibility for telling that story accurately. Do you guys feel that same bear of responsibility?
Well, let me go back to the movie Laura. I mean, are you familiar with the film?
Yes, yeah.
There you go, same concept. I mean, Dana Andrews is determined, you know, that he needs to figure this out. Granted, in the film, she turns out to still be alive. But, yeah, I feel as though Krista is someone that I might not necessarily have liked had I actually met her, and yet I do feel some responsibility because to a very large extent she was being forgotten, and I think that we've done quite a bit to make sure that she is not forgotten and that more and more people are now remembering or at least discovering her story. We never really found enough of the missing pieces to put together a biography. I wish I could say we could do a book on this, but there's no ending without knowing who killed her even. So, you know, there is no real book there. So as much as I would like to have that, without that, at the same time, keeping the name out there, keeping the story out there, keeping people curious as to what happened. Maybe someday, as my wife says, somebody will come forward with more information.
And for me, my tie-in was Nicole, because here was a little girl whose mother did everything she could for her, who suddenly had her mom taken away from her.
Was she a traditional mother? No.
No.
And a lot of people on the internet put Krista down. But from everything that we have heard, and I have no reason to doubt this from the sources we've heard it from, she really, really did everything to try to take care of her
Krista
daughter.
Krista did the best she could in the way she knew how.
Yeah.
That might not be the way everybody else would have played it, but, you know, she... the very first thing that she did when she got any money was she got Nicole's eyes fixed.
Yeah.
You know, it was this was, you know, you look at what is important to somebody, and it was always what she needed to do to take care of Nicole.
And we go back again to the fact that it was the 70s. The 70s was a different world, so we can't look at it from today's perspective.